I'm extremely grateful to the Lancaster Interchurch Peace Witness. I'm on the program committee of that organization, and Holy Trinity Lutheran Church for partnering with the seminary in making this event possible. And so I'll begin to introduce our speaker. The Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch is the senior religion editor for the Huffington Post. From 2003 to 2011, he was the associate dean of religious life in the chapel at Princeton University. Paul enjoyed a career as a disc jockey and a record producer in Barcelona. Prior to enrolling at the Union Theological Seminary in New York City, he's a graduate of that institution and an ordained American Baptist minister. While Paul was at Princeton, he devoted himself to interfaith relations on campus and served as co-director of the Program on Religion, Diplomacy, and International Relations at Princeton's Liechtenstein Institute on Self-Determination. Paul was a founding editor of BeliefNet.com, and his first book, Teen Spirit, One World, Many Faiths, was released in the fall of 2004. Paul also edited the 100th anniversary edition of the famous work by his great-grandfather Walter Rauschenbusch, Christianity and the Social Crisis, with a new subtitle, In the 21st Century. At the Huffington Post, Paul has developed initiatives in interfaith awareness. He's recruited an incredibly diverse array of authors, editors, and reporters. He's cultivated responsible biblical interpretation online, which is a very rare thing. And he's even devoted an online pastoral touch by doing on-the-street interviews in Central Park and with his Ask Pastor Paul column. One of the things that the Huffington Post religion section has done amazingly well is respond with informed commentary and news when news is breaking out in the world, as is the case with the Libyan consulate crisis just recently. So Paul is extremely well-suited to deliver an address to us on the topic religion in an internet age. I invite you to welcome the Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch.
Thank you so much, Professor Carey and President. I am very glad to be here at Lancaster Theological Seminary, and I have been, fed while here. I have never eaten so much in my life. I have loved Lancaster, and I had a great experience yesterday with the Lancaster Interchurch Peace Witness, and I'm delighted to be with you today to talk about religion and the internet. And I want to first say, you know, sometimes they say put away your cell phones. Don't do that here. If you want to keep them out, that's totally fine. If you want to tweet out anything during this talk, please do. If you want to tweet me, my handle is Rauschenbusch. So please, this is a time when it's okay to have your equipment in hand. But I think for the question and answers, we still may go with like kind of old school mics. Is that right? Okay. So just to start, who here thinks that the internet has a positive effect on religion? Hands up. Okay. Who would say a negative effect? And who would say both? Okay, I'm also in that category of both, but to put my cards on the table, the name of this lecture basically is The Internet, Both a Blessing and a Curse. I want to talk to you a little bit today about both the positive and the negative aspects of the internet. But basically my altar call here is that I am trying to encourage people of goodwill to be involved with the internet, because I think we need to make the internet basically a better place. And so one thing that I want to start with is that the internet is not going away. Because I think some people are hoping that it might and that they can just ignore it and it will go away. But this is going to be a part of our future. In the mid-20th century, There was a Catholic priest named Teilhard de Chardin who kind of anticipated this thinking sphere that would cover the globe called the noosphere. And this may not be exactly what he had in mind, but it is that essentially thing that connects us all. This connected layer is in existence. When you've heard that phrase of a butterfly on one side of the world, you know, having, you know, wapping its wing and having effects over here, this technology has made that very plain. And it can be wonderful. It can bring messages of salvation, calls to social justice, all sorts of sense of solidarity and compassion with people who are suffering. We've seen that with the Haiti earthquake. We've seen that with the tsunami. We even saw that with a bullied school bus monitor. But on the other hand, the internet can foster messages of hate, of destruction. It can rupture ties. We've recently had a very trying time with a couple of malicious filmmakers making an awful film and with the intent of provoking, and they were successful. And no one was there, no one needed to help them to do what they did. They could do it all on their own. Terry Jones, when he burnt his Quran, the media had a blackout on it. We decided we're not going to cover this. He didn't need us. He uploaded his video onto the web. People in Afghanistan saw it, and riots ensued. So when we talk about the internet, we are truly talking about life and death. It is the most powerful, transformative innovation in communication and personal interactions of our generation, and maybe in any generation. And its implications for religious traditions and personal belief and identity are just beginning to be felt and understood. So I've been working on the internet for over a decade now, and I launched the religion section of the Huffington Post with a blog post called Dear Religious and Sane America. Because I wanted this place to be a place where we could actually have a positive, productive religious conversation. So I want to just read you the mission statement for the Huffington Post religion section now. Huffington Post religion is dedicated to providing positive encounters with religious wisdom and ideas. The site offers the opportunity for learning and cooperation across religious divisions and encourages productive discourse on the many different ways religion influences personal, communal, national, and international life. The tone of HuffPost religion is intelligent, creative, forward-thinking, rigorous, and is marked by a generosity towards religious people and a respect for religious tradition. So fulfilling that mission is what I spend all my time on, 24/7, literally. I am, you know, reporting on things in the religious area, and some of it I have to, you know, I don't need to tell you, is not great. But at the same time, what I'm trying to do is push out as many positive, productive, intelligent religious information so that people who are seeking religious wisdom might find something that provides a bridge of understanding rather than a bomb of destruction. What I'm doing is a ministry. So let me ask another question. How many of you view the internet as part of your personal religious practice? How many of you have ever searched online for scripture or prayers or sermons or meditations? Okay, so let me ask again. How many of you view the internet as part of your religious practice? Because many of you are using the internet. And it's interesting, that questioning that I just did, there's been some interesting, I'm going to get into some statistics, but I talked to the head of the Pew Research on religion and the internet, and he said the response was exactly paralleled in their thing. When you ask people, does the religion help you with your personal practice? Everybody says no. And then you ask them, have you ever looked up any scripture? And everybody says, yeah, of course I have. So we represent, you know, this is very, but it's a way of rethinking what the power and the possibilities of the internet are. So here's a few statistics that we might keep in mind. And it's important to remember that the internet is so young. It's 20 years old. And Twitter is 5 years old. I mean, these things, this is, everything is in its infancy. We are just beginning to understand what this might be. And yet, no matter even how young all of this technology is, 3/4 of Americans use this technology every week. So just to back up, in the year 2000, 21% of internet users had gone online to find some sort of spiritual information. By 2004, it was up to 64%. And in Pew's most recent study on religious people in the community, it found that in 2011, 79% of Americans active in religious groups are internet users. 82% of Americans are on the internet for an average of 18 hours a week. So, and 12 hours of those are at home. And number, number of text messages sent by cell phones has increased more than 300% in only 4 years and now reaches an average of 48 per day. So these are just a few of the, you know, kind of statistics that are out there to show that we are inundated with the internet and it's not going away. So I want to talk a little bit about the blessings and the curses. And blessings and curses is a little Manichaean, as you seminarians will understand. But I would say that there is a lot of activity that is really bad, and there is also so much that is life-giving and good. But what it really is a mixture. And what really matters, and for all of us, it really matters what our intention is when we go on the internet and how we use the internet. And so that's really what I want to talk about today. So the first category I want to cover is information. The internet can bring into our hands an amazing array of information. It is an incredible tool. With a click, you can visit websites that represent your own faith. You can read official viewpoints. You can hear stories, liturgical observances. You can hear testimonies of your fellow adherents. You can read histories and profiles of famous religious peoples. You can research scripture and interpretation of scripture, meditation, prayers. All is available to you in a click. If you have a smartphone, you have the largest theological library that ever existed. Each day, more text, more theological reflections, more podcasts are being uploaded into the web from all sorts of tradition around the world. It was absolutely extraordinary. And this information can help us in our practice of our spiritual lives. I recently had a very poignant example of this. My partner's mother, who was 88, and all of a sudden went into ICU very unexpectedly, and had, you know, and then went moved directly into hospice and had 3 hours to live. And basically, you know, we were totally caught off guard. I looked into my iPhone, I found the Episcopalian prayers for the dying. I was able to offer those prayers while she was dying, and then when she died, we offered the prayers for the dead. We would have been caught without it. We didn't have the resources, but because of the availability of the that the Episcopalian Church had decided to put their prayers online. I mean, it could have been easier to find them, but I did. And it really I mean, anyway, that's a whole nother thing. But the truth is that our experience of her death was absolutely transformed by the fact that we were able to have that resource at hand that we would not have had 5 years ago, or maybe 10 years ago. So not only can I find out information about my own faith, but I have an amazing ability to find out information about other people's faith. Geography no longer makes any difference. Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, Hindu, Jewish, Baha'i, pagan, you name it, there are websites with amazing information out there. And not only can you learn facts, but if you really want to get into it, you can learn about the experience, the religious experience of others. So if you go on to Huffington Post Religion, you're always, if you'll notice, you're always going to find side by side Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Hindu experiences, and you can click on those, and you can learn about what people, very different faith traditions, very different geography, very different culture, are experiencing around religion and spirituality. A recent example of this is that we had an amazing experience with the Muslim time of Ramadan. And we had a young imam who's the NYU chaplain, and he every day would write a reflection for Ramadan. And I followed it. I loved it. Every day I would read it. And it's not my tradition, and I have no intention of becoming Muslim. But I could see the depth of his wrestling, of his wisdom, of the knowledge. It was very beautiful and very powerful. And the internet allows me to do that when before it might have been hard to find a Muslim to be interacting with in that way. So the information about religion is incredibly available, and people are researching it at a staggering rate. But the curse is there incredible misinformation on the web, put there either by people who are ignorant or who are willfully malicious and are trying to influence you and mislead you. To the uninformed internet user, one religion site looks like the other, and size and quality has nothing to do with it. Anyone who knows how to do it can create a really cool-looking website. That means nothing. So you need to know how to figure out where are these people coming from. My personal context is I know a lot more about Judaism and Christianity than I do about Hinduism or Sikhism or Jainism. And so I need to go deeper. I need to say, I need to click about us. I need to figure out who's behind this website so I make sure that I understand who I'm listening to. Because you have to know who's behind the online presence. There's always someone behind it. And this becomes problematic because the search engines such as Google and Yahoo are like the shamans of the internet. They connect you. They guide you. And yet, there's a very complex, not transparent rules about how they are leading people. And it can lead you to very bad places. For instance, if you search Jew in Google, the second site that comes up is an Aryan Nation site that has horrible misinformation about the Jewish people. That site won the search for Jew, meaning that you will consistently go to their site. And that is just that is what I'm talking about. There are organized campaigns online against different religious traditions. So you have to know what you're looking for. And so in order for the internet to be a blessing rather than a curse, we need to figure out how to search for authentic and accurate information on the web and teach others how to do the same. I feel that every church, and because I'm speaking to you, but mosque center should have trainings on the internet. Trainings about the internet. How are you interacting with the internet? So you don't leave it up to chance for where people are getting their information. The best way for this to happen is for people like yourselves, who are religious leaders, to take responsibility and be active online and point people towards information that will enlighten our minds and feed our spirits. So the second way that the internet is both a blessing and a curse is how it functions with religious authority. And this might get a little personal, because you are all in religious authority positions or in some way or another. So the web is radically egalitarian, and I'm a Baptist now, and so that seems good to me. But gone are the days when religious authorities were able to maintain themselves simply because they were the keepers of information and didn't allow people to find other ways of connecting with thoughts that differ. So religious authorities had a way of basically stopping people from getting information that they considered dangerous. This played out very interestingly in a couple ways. One, my religion reporter by the name of Javed Kalim, who's amazing, he wrote a piece called The New Radical Islam. But what it was about were about progressive Muslims who had women and gay people leading mosques. And the only way they were able to organize was through the internet. because they could find each other that way, and then they could move offline and actually create gatherings that were not just virtual. But the way it happened was through the internet. They could circumvent religious authorities that did not want this to happen, and they could they would find each other. Another example is if you've been following any of the conferences last summer, the Presbyterians met, the Methodists met, and the entire thing was live streamed, was tweeted, was everything. Everything was very transparent. So people really knew what was happening at the very moment it was happening. And there's no ability to have these kind of backroom deals. The laity is very present via the internet. No matter if they're in Africa or if they're in Kansas, they know what's happening in Tampa. So another example is my advice column called Ask Pastor Paul. And so when I first started, people would submit all these questions that somehow they didn't feel comfortable asking their own religious leader for, because they felt like there might be some sort of reprisal. And my advice may or may not have been what their pastor would have said. So this is why religious groups are often really threatened by the internet, and because it challenges authority. So recently, 30,000 ultra-Orthodox Jews rallied in Shea Stadium specifically to fight against, quote, the evils of the internet and damage of advanced devices. So this happened in Shea Stadium in New York, and it was amazing. It was just filled with ultra-Orthodox Jews. Of course, a lot of the ways they were getting out the information about the rally was through Twitter, and you could also buy, it sold out, and so you could, the rumor had it that there were tickets available on eBay if you wanted to get them. But there are internet jamming devices in yeshivas. There was a movement towards kosher phones that would only allow in things that were in accordance with Orthodox Jewish laws. So there's a real sense of threat that the internet brings, and not only in politics, such as the Arab Spring, but also in religion. The authority vacuum creates interesting dilemmas, because it is just as easy to find the Gnostic Gospels as it is the canonical Gospels. And you can see different translations, and you can see different interpretations, and you can see different reflections. So all of that is out there, and no one can really control it. Individuals will self-appoint themselves as authorities without any sort of backing. You have theologians. you have religious prophets online. And they can be convincing, and they can be active. And in some ways, this is liberating, and in some ways, this is very disconcerting. A few years ago, a priest led a mass in a place called Second Life, which used to be very big. It's faded now. But it was basically this kind of virtual reality other world that people got very into. But the truth is that the priest was not a priest, and the mass was not a mass. And yet, if you went a little bit further somewhere in Second Life, there were very real Anglicans who were constructing very real cathedrals. And so how do you discern who is actually talking about faith in what way? So the Pope has gotten very interested in the game of the internet because they're worried about this very question of authority. And so the Pope has encouraged all of his priests to use the technology and, as an effective way of getting out the word, but also to kind of reclaim control of what is Orthodox Catholicism. This last Lent, the Pope tweeted every day, and he... so it's the worst Twitter name ever. Pope to you, Vatican. I mean, it's such a bad Twitter handle that John Stewart made fun of him. But but anyway, he did tweet out. I mean, the Pope, I don't know, he decided that this was an important part of who he had to be. So while a democratic and even anarchistic web is it has advantages. It has freedom, and it can be a way of breaking free of old dogmas that can oppress certain populations. It can, you know, help increase pluralism and all sorts of things, but it can also lead to very serious problems. So people with no credentials can rise to prominence because they know how to game the system. They can, people with no credentials can urge people to do very dangerous acts. For instance, the same freedom that allowed these progressive Muslims to gather in community is also that freedom which connects lone wolf Muslims in America to people who do not have their best interests in mind. Studies have determined that many of the Muslims who were security threats tended to be those who did not go to mosque, who did not have an imam who could be a correcting figure in their life. Instead, they went to the internet and they found people who would encourage their sense of isolation and alienation. And so this is something to consider when people talk about how mosques should not be built. In fact, mosques should be built so that we have positive Muslim religious figures. This is also true, I would say, for other militias, for Christian militias, and anyone who is distorting religious values for extremism and violence. So making sure we know who we are following, who we are paying attention to, is the best way of making sure that the internet is a blessing. And it calls upon religious leaders to make their presence known so that they can be the ones who are teaching the deep truth and wisdom of our religious traditions, rather than allowing people to fill the vacuum and teach false and potentially very dangerous teachings. And one of the most celebrated aspects of the internet is the way it can increase communication and community among people. So the internet renders factors that we often define as our communities, such as geography, physical characteristics, race, gender, nationality, even religion, to a position that is secondary to the act of choosing identity, choosing your ideas, choosing your beliefs that you can assemble as an individual. So using Facebook, Tumblr, Pinterest, a person can basically create a mix of a spirituality that draws from Rumi and St. Augustine and Nina Simone to create an online identity that is unique, personally liberating, and putting you in touch with all sorts of different kinds of people who celebrate different parts of ourselves. Online community is really about who you choose to be networked with rather than those who live on your street or your town. The ability to connect with people miles away can be incredibly liberating and comforting. I had a Buddhist student at Princeton who went home to South Carolina for the summer and didn't have any sort of community there. Instead, she connected in a very sort of in a daily way with a Buddhist community in New York that she had met, and every day she would be in contact with them. She would be podcasting with them, listen to podcasts from them, and it was a way for her to feel she could own her own spirituality while geographically being very far from others who shared it. So you can be. You can really create any sort of presence on a community. You can hook into all sorts of different communities, and it can help you connect with people who you never would otherwise connect with. There was an African American pastor in Maryland who just had it in his heart to start praying for the people of Africa. And he started praying, and he put his prayers up online, and within a year, he had 100,000 people in Africa who would every day come to listen to his prayers, and eventually, some of those folks got together and got the money together to bring him over in person. So this kind of connection would never have been able to happen without Facebook. So this is, online communities, religious communities can follow their pastor on Twitter, on Facebook, and these things are about communication. They're not just one way. You just put up something and then people can listen to it. A lot of ways, this is a way that pastors and their congregations are communicating throughout the week when they otherwise wouldn't be able to do that. So I've told pastors who like are saying, I don't know about Twitter, I don't know how to do it. I was like, listen, if your congregation wants you to tweet, that is a compliment. It means that they want to hear more from you rather than less, which is a good thing. So, but when it comes down to it, we go online alone. The internet can lead to a kind of crazy kind of individualism. Online community is too easy to fracture. And people can just delete, we can unfriend each other, we can unfollow each other. So, and while I'm on this subject, there's the other thing about community that is problematic is that there is a sense of anonymity and a power of that anonymity that could be incredibly hateful and hurtful. One of the painful things about my work at Huffington Post is how vicious people can be in the comments section. I think I told Professor Carey, just don't look at the comments because it'll just make you sick. People seem to go out of their way to be unkind. And I think in part of it is because they don't have to own it. They don't have to own what they're saying. And I think it's such an important thing for people to realize that if we're going to have integrity in our lives, it has to include what we do online as well as offline. I had an exception to this. My nephew died tragically at the age of 20, and I put my eulogy online about it. And it was interesting because, people were very, very supportive. And one guy actually said, oh, well, I'm sorry about your nephew, but it's too bad you believe in a fairy tale about God or anything like that. And the rest of them kind of ganged up on him and said, just lay off. This is not the time for that. And people shared their own stories of loss. And so there was a certain way that my vulnerability, actually like really putting it out there, provoked or invoked a vulnerability and a willingness to share about other people's pain. So I think there's a possibility there. I think it's very important how we interact with one another on the internet is really important. I'd love to hear more about what you think. And finally, I just want to touch briefly on the implications of the technology of the internet itself. So there's basically an app for every spiritual act. So you can go online and you can visit a Hindu shrine and you can, with a click of a mouse, you can light a candle and you can start the incense and then you can put some flowers there and you can donate money and to say a mantra. And you can go to a virtual wailing wall and you can put in a prayer if you like. Or you can actually go to a website where you can do that and then a real person will go and put in the prayer for you. There was a prayer app I heard about where it just had a blank screen and you write your prayer to God and you press send. And, you know, where does that go? You don't even get a reply. There's no reply email. So does that go to God? And I think it's a really interesting question because is that fundamentally different in intention from doing this and saying, God, I need you. If someone is at their desk and they are hurting and they use that app and say, God, I am so alone, send. Is that fundamentally different than doing any other posture? I think it's an interesting question. So if we tend to ridicule the ritual, the virtual ritual, but you know sometimes our lives. I mean, I sit all day in front of a computer, and if I were to listen to a meditation of Saint Francis, and came away with more peace, and being kinder to my colleagues, is that less than going to a taizé service? I think it's a really interesting question. But the internet does, you know, it raises some important questions. You know, Nicholas Carr wrote a book called The Shallows, which talks about is the internet fundamentally changing the way we are able to stay with topics and go deep. Now, I don't know. I spent 8 years at Princeton, and I rarely encountered such depth as the young people who I meet with today. But I think these are important questions. And a rabbi recently tweeted out the entire Exodus narrative over Passover, but another rabbi wrote something. Wrote an interesting piece called "Judaism is not a Twitterable religion." And he said, this content is not Twitterable. The journey of a meaningful Jewish life needs wide bandwidth. It requires knowledge, time, and commitment. If we want Judaism to have a great future and not merely a great past, we need to set our sights higher and deeper. And the reason I saw that piece was because I saw it being tweeted and retweeted and retweeted. So the question is how do we use technology not as a replacement for deep reflection, but as a way to guide us towards it? And I want to just end with some insights from a scholar named Heidi Campbell. And she wrote something that I think, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but I think it's an interesting question. She says, while initial speculation suggested that the nature of contemporary religion might be completely altered due to online engagement, current research suggests that the features of religion online closely mirror changes within the practice of religion in contemporary society. So it's not necessarily pushing the changes, but questions of religious identity, authority, community, imagination are already questions that are fluid in the 21st century. And the internet, instead of being the main mover behind that, is merely reflecting that in a kind of technicolor way. I'll lead you with just basically the altar call again. We all need to be part of this conversation. We need to figure out a way not to let the internet totally overwhelm us, but rather to be intentional about how we are online, how our presence online actually reflects the deep faith and belief that we hold in our entire lives. And it's really up to people of goodwill like yourselves to make sure that the internet is a blessing rather than a curse in the 21st century and beyond. Thank you so much. I look forward to talking.
We do have a bit of time for conversation. I'd ask you to raise your hand. I'll bring the microphone so that everyone can hear your question or comment.
I was laughing at your comment about how misleading things are when you look for something on the internet. I typed in Lancaster Theological Seminary, and I got Lancaster Bible College. Just funny.
That's actually... But I should... Can I just make a comment about that? That means that you need to work harder. Because one of the things that I do every... Not you. I'm just saying, like, one of the things... Listen, as a president of a seminary, I know that there's almost no one who's working harder. But what, you know, every day at Huffington Post, we have workshops about how to win searches. So it's that part, there is knowledge that is out there. And there is a way to win that search, and you guys have to win it. So I don't mean everybody is working very hard, but that's something that should not be happening. And there is a way to have it not happen.
Right. Yes. Well, just one other quick comment. We often think of the reign of God as when we turn things upside down, the rich become the poor and the poor become the rich and so forth. One thing that I think some of us older people feel is that the world has been turned upside down. It's the younger people who can do this, and that's a struggle for some of us. Just want to acknowledge that.
Yeah. Well, I also often say that, like, I am twice as old as anyone on my team. You know, it's Ariana and I with our walkers. and the rest of them are all 20. But it's also, again, I don't think everybody has to become an internet aficionado. Everybody doesn't have to know the ins and outs. But the demystification of the internet is something that can happen pretty quickly. I mean, one of my greatest feats this summer was to get Karen Armstrong on Twitter. And now she is a maniac because she figured out, oh, I can do this. You know what I mean? But there was a mystification about, like, how hard it was. And I think this should never, that does not need to overwhelm. There is a way to figure out how to parse this that works for you. And that's for everyone. But it also doesn't have to be a part of everyone's life. I want people of goodwill, but my father just has no interest in being a good presence on the internet. But he, you know, I mean, I don't want it to be. I'm learning things every day, and it's possible to learn enough and not have it continuously overwhelm you. So I encourage. I think it would be great to, you know, people could teach this to you. I mean, I teach young people and old people about, like, the internet and blogging and things like that. And it's possible to learn. So I appreciate the anxiety, but I don't think you can let it stop you.
You have too much to talk about. I had to write it down. One of the things I got from you is, first of all, that I've been concerned about for years is that the mainline media almost always portrays religion as being on the fringe. They almost always put the crazy people out there, and they never want to hear what, you know, Cornel West has to say, or, you know, someone with a brain. And so, you know,
Cornel West?
I love Cornel West. Well, maybe.
I love Cornel West. I know him very well, but he's all over the media.
Oh, but now he is, but maybe, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, but they rarely do this. This gives everyone a chance at least to be heard. And the internet is very much like the emerging church. You know, it's kind of, like you were saying, picking and choosing things. But I think the problem with a lot of the religious stuff on the internet is that, like John Wesley, when he would preach in the fields, he'd say, now go to church. And a lot of the people don't, a lot of the internet stuff, they don't really do much of that.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of the question.
John Wesley would preach in fields, and people thought that was a little bit out there, but he would always encourage folks to connect with the church, and I don't see that happening as much with religion on the internet. Maybe you do.
Well, I will say an interesting example of this is Trinity Church in Chicago, Trinity UCC, which... Well, they have an amazing online. They've hired two people who just deal with online, and they get something like I don't know how many people, like 10,000 people who watch their who watch their service, and actually they're the most consistent givers out there. It's very interesting because they don't stay home when it snows, you know. And so it's, you know, I would say that there's a way for the church and for churches to again to encourage community, encourage their own community to be reaching out, to be outwardly focused, and I think that's a really important thing to remember. One of I'll mention this, and because your comment kind of provoked it. But the truth is that all of us like to click on bad news, including bad religious people. Ooh, I just want to click on that and read it, and I know that because I know exactly what people are clicking on, and every media outlet knows exactly what you're clicking on. And if you're clicking on, and this is also has to do with, you know, we know exactly what you're, you know, flipping the channel towards. If you will, I can run a really nice story about religious people and no one cares. And I still run them. But let me just tell you, like, media companies are for profit. If everyone clicked on the good story, they would start playing more good stories. But no, it's God Hates Fags, Fred Phelps Church. Click, 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 click. Oh, I just hate them. You know, but we have to put it out there because people will click on it. So watch your own media consumption, because we know exactly what you're doing.
Yeah, Mike, you know, just listening to you, it's very fascinating, but very scary.
I'm delighted.
The reason I say this is because I see the internet as a weapon, and in the sense that it can do both good and bad, as you yourself have pointed out. Is there any way gurus like you, who are internet savvy, can look at ways to be able to maybe put some kind of rules on how it can be used, just like guns? I mean, it can be good and bad. Knives are good and bad, but there are rules on how they can be used. With the internet just left open out there, people using it in any shape or form they want, we're seeing how many people have been killed even just recently from just that little weapon. Of a film went out and bang, it goes all over the world.
Yeah.
Is there any way gurus like you can look at ways, and you know, especially through religion, whereby things can be filtered, or there are rules of what can or cannot be on the internet for all of us to use? I mean, some of us, like the president said, are old people who are not conversant with this internet thing. So the chances of us maybe putting something out there is probably very slim. But you've seen what the internet is doing currently in our media. So I'm just wondering what you guys are doing about it.
Right. I mean, I think it's a very interesting question. It gets into the question of freedom of expression. It gets into the question of who makes those rules. How do you decide what gets filtered? Who do you trust? I happen to be strongly in favor of an open internet because I am very... The people who generally have the power to make those decisions have a lot of self-interest. And so the question is, how do we, without restricting and without without like relieving ourselves of some basic values of freedom, which are important. For instance, you know, we saw in the Arab Spring that they tried to shut down the internet. They tried to shut down all these ways that people could communicate because they realized it is a weapon, it is a threat, it is a way for people to organize. And so I think part of the question is how can we turn it into a positive tool without trying to limit it? Because I think that would backfire. I think eventually you would find that something you wanted out there would be something that someone who had power over you would restrict eventually. And so that is I don't think that's the solution. But I do appreciate the question is how to, again, and that's what I tried to get into, how do we turn this towards a positivity without getting ourselves into a kind of restrictive mode, which eventually I think would backfire.
You were talking a little bit about Trinity UCC and some of the things they're doing online, and they obviously have a lot of resources, and I have a little bit of envy of the number of staffers they have to do things like that. As a solo pastor of a very small church, looking at all of the tools that are out there with Twitter and Facebook and blogging and limited time, where should somebody start to be most effective in reaching out, especially if you have predominantly an aging congregation that isn't quite ready to do that with you, but you know that's where you need to go? How do you do that?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I think you just need to figure out, you should step back and think about what is your internet plan? What do you want to accomplish? Do you want to reach the people who are in your congregation? Do you want to be a presence in your wider community? All of these need to be part of what you factor into the initial question of how to get out there. I think, you know, Facebook is a pretty pretty accessible and eventually pretty easy tool. And it's a way of promoting who you are in a wider world. And you can easily message people and say, hey, just a heads up, this is what we're doing. And it doesn't have to be, I wish you'd come to the potluck. I mean, it can be inspirational. You know, I mean, one of the things that is has been most powerful for us, because we tweet, and Facebook all the time for Post Religion. What is clear is that people are looking for inspiration. So if you put in a MLK quote or Mother Teresa quote, people will click and share. And that will bring information. If you put in something like, "Hey, look at this beautiful picture of Lancaster in the fall," and God is good, people would click on that and they would share it, and they would eventually know where it came from. So I would just think of it in terms of who you want to be in the world, and make it. I've heard this a lot from single pastors. It's incredible the stress you're under. Don't make it a big thing. If you tweet once a day and you tweet a prayer saying, "I am praying for all of our members that they might be safe from harm and find joy today." Boom, send. That's it for the day. That's a Twitter presence. And that's the kind of tweet that people would forward. So there's a way to make it work. Given all the other responsibilities that you had, there's a way to make it work that doesn't require a lot of extra. Or maybe you really give this an opportunity. If there's any young people, say $10 a week or $10, I'll pay you $20 a week. Meet with me. We'll go over the strategy for the week for a young person in your congregation. Who might have more of a sense of it. And they might get into it. And they might own the church more. Meaning they are the ones who are putting the church online? How cool is that? And so figure out what the resources are that you don't... I mean, Trinity, yeah, is big, but they've just decided. They took money that they could have used for other things. And they decided, this is going to be part of who we are. We're going to be a national, international church. You don't have to do that. You can be a local church that people turn to for inspiration and excitement. And then, it's not a panacea. It's not we'll have hundreds of people coming through the door and everything will change. Maybe that will happen. Or maybe it's just a way for you to reach people that you wouldn't have otherwise.
We have a queue of three more questions. Oh, I thought, three again.
Oh, okay, I didn't know. Kind of to answer the young woman's question over there, but I want to touch on one point before I go and share what I do personally, is the integrity piece is important, I think particularly as a pastor. I have actually taught a seminar on boundary training for when you're going to be an online presence and you're going to do that. I think you need to sort of know in your own mind, what parts do I share? What parts don't I share out of my personal life? Where do I go? For example, I would love to do politics on Facebook, but I don't, because I have friends on all across the spectrum. And so I just think that's not appropriate. But actually what I do is kind of do my Norman Vincent Peale act on Facebook. And that's like you're saying, put a Bible verse on maybe during the day, or I have a lot of friends that are putting positive little pictures and things on, share those. And then the other thing that I have done is, especially with my 20-somethings that I'm friends with Facebook, and some of them haven't been in the church for three or four years, some of the young couples. Recently, one of them was going through a challenging time. They were putting on their status all the time. I'm going to the doctor, I'm doing this. And I sent her a private message, every 2 days saying, you're in my prayers. Let me know if there's anything you can do. So I think there's a sense of, think about it as a pastoral presence online is really how I try to put it. And to just, it's an extension of my pastoral ministry, just another way.
Exactly.
Yeah, as a local church pastor, it's always kind of an interesting situation when you have some of the older generation really cool now with email, that's the newest thing, and they're really cool. And you send that out to the youth, and they're like, "We don't do that, and we haven't checked it." But one thing that I really kind of got sort of my mind focused on recently it happened at the National Youth Event, United Church of Christ National Youth Event, and they tried to varying degrees to use Twitter and different, you know, gadgets and stuff like that. You know, I pastor a church in rural western Pennsylvania, northern Appalachia, and it's really become sort of technology also becomes sort of a justice issue for me, because I see, you know, some of these youth, they don't have, you know, the smartphones or the iPads to do these things, and are excluded whenever there's no printed packet of the materials, worship materials. They're online. If you have an iPad, smartphone, great. If you don't, your pastor usually prints a bunch of it out, but if we're not on the ball, that doesn't happen. So when you're organizing that in your community, be thinking about that would be my advice, if I have any advice to give. And then the second thing kind of along with that is that, you know, even when you're texting some of these kids, you know, they have track phones and stuff because they can't afford the full thing, that their text messages you do deluge them with becomes a real issue too. So just a thing in that way, and bars are an issue in our county, not drinking bars, but bars of service. You know, you just don't get internet everywhere. For some of our members, the real cool thing is cable TV still, so right. Thank you.
No, it's definitely, you know, the kind of the digital divide is still a real issue, and it has to be addressed at a very local level. I think we were talking the other night about this at the UCC National Gathering, and they kind of assumed everyone had a smartphone, which is a major mistake. I don't think you need to, you should ever assume that. But the truth is that, you know, more and more people will have them. I think that this is, you know, it's become less expensive, and I think probably within the next 10 years, landline phones will go away, and most people, although young people, like my brother doesn't let my, he has the means, but he doesn't let his children have smartphones until they hit 16. So I don't think, you know, I think you should definitely be aware of who you are trying to communicate and how, that's for sure.
I don't know whether you saw the New York Times yesterday or not, a long article on the internet and a concern that it's so overloaded that it may get so that it will...
That the internet may break down?
Yeah, uh-huh. Right, because it's so overloaded. It was a long article. I can't give you the full details of it, but you might want to look at it.
I will look at it. I haven't, I you know... That would give me definitely a few days off. So I have mixed feelings about that information.
I'm sorry that we can't take the other questions that I saw. Reverend Rauschenbusch is stuck with a train schedule, and we hope to feed him lunch and all of that. So I will ask you after lecture not to treat him like Snooki and surround him and keep him from moving along. But this, then, would be your opportunity to show your appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you so much.